$187 billion. On top of that, a couple hundred billion was diverted away from the direct spending economists were calling for and instead used to cut taxes for individuals and businesses. That's what it took to get Arlen Specter, who would soon defect to the Democratic caucus, and Maine's two moderate senators, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins, on board. Thanks to those three and not one other Republican, the stimulus package barely broke Mitch McConnell's filibuster and passed in the Senate over the hysterical denunciations of the rest of the Republican caucus. And then, when it went to the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats had to pass it all by themselves. It received not one single Republican vote, which Republicans celebrated like they just won the Super Bowl. A few of them even lit a cop car on fire. And then, having enjoyed making a big show out of refusing to help the president succeed, Republicans then turned to making a big show out of complaining that he had failed. In reality, he hadn't. The stimulus kept us from falling into another Great Depression and created millions of jobs. But it took a while to kick in, and it wasn't as strong as President Obama and Democrats wanted, or as economists had called for. It's hard to get people excited about avoiding a hypothetical depression when you're slowly muddling through a huge recession. The economy didn't feel stimulated, so it was very easy for Republicans to win the messaging fight. At a caucus meeting months later, Harry Reid reminded us Democrats that the stimulus had included the biggest middle-class tax cut in history. True. Sherrod Brown leaned over to me and grumbled sarcastically, "Yeah, I get thanked for that every day." People had no idea, because while the Bush administration had celebrated its 2001 tax cut by mailing taxpayers a letter at taxpayer expense announcing it, this time Americans simply had a little less withheld in every paycheck. Meanwhile, the construction jobs, the infrastructure upgrades, the shovel-ready projects all across the country, well, the Obama administration put up signs at all these sites. But the signs read, "Funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act." The what? Democrats have always had a disadvantage in messaging. Not because we're idiots, but because we have complex ideas and sometimes a hard time explaining them succinctly. Our bumper stickers always end with, "Continued on next bumper sticker." And by the time I got to the Senate in July, Republicans were giddily and successfully blaming the still sluggish economy on Obama's failed stimulus, which didn't stop them from simultaneously taking credit for stimulus projects in their districts, grinning widely for photos at groundbreakings and later ribbon cuttings. Not long after I got into office, I went to a groundbreaking ceremony in Maple Grove for a 3-mile, $47 million extension of Minnesota State Highway 610, made possible by an infusion of $27 million in stimulus funds. There were about a dozen public officials there, a few state legislators, a mayor or two, some county commissioners, and Senator Klobuchar and me. I was surprised to see Minnesota's 3rd District Republican Congressman Eric Paulson, who, like every House Republican, had voted against the stimulus, smiling under his hard hat. When I got up to speak, I said, "Well, I certainly don't deserve any credit for this. I got to the Senate after the stimulus was passed. I guess we should thank the members of Congress here who voted for the stimulus." I looked down the line of hard hats and said, "Okay, there's Amy Klobuchar. Let's hear it for Amy." Applause. "And let's see." I continued looking directly at Representative Paulson. "Well, I guess just Amy." Meanwhile, presiding over the Senate, I heard Republican senators claim that the only jobs created by the stimulus had been for federal bureaucrats. Presumably, these included federal bureaucrats who had moved to Minnesota to operate the excavators, bulldozers, compactors, and pavers to build the 3-mile extension of Highway 610. The stimulus had been a successful test run of the Republican strategy: abdicate their responsibility to govern, obstruct the president's agenda, complain that things weren't getting better, and wait for Americans to get fed up so they could profit politically at his expense. Operation Kirtle was well underway, and any notion of building a better politics, any hope of changing the tone in Washington, was quickly erased. Soon after I walked into this mess, I asked a few of my veteran colleagues if it had ever been this bad. Sure, a couple of them said. Remember that guy who almost got caned to death on the Senate floor? Charles Sumner? Yeah, that guy. So the one time that anyone could think of when it was this bad was the near fatal beating of a sitting senator in the lead up to the Civil War and the deaths of more than 600,000 Americans. But then again, that was the summer of 2009. It actually got worse from there. That September, a South Carolina Republican congressman named Joe Wilson interrupted President Obama during an address to a joint session of Congress, shouting, "You lie!" It was a pretty shocking breach of protocol, but over the next 4 days, Wilson took in $1 million in campaign donations. Stuff like this was already becoming par for the course. Republicans had already decided to disregard President Obama's mandate, and some were even going so far as to question his legitimacy. After listening to one too many examples of a sitting congressman fanning the flames of the birther myth, I told Drew that I wanted the Capitol Police to install a special metal detector before the State of the Union address for any member of Congress who didn't believe the president was born in the United States. Drew thought I was joking. I think. But I made a serious case. If you believe that Obama wasn't born in Hawaii, I reasoned, it meant two things. One, you were generally insane. And two, you believe that the president was a usurper. Exactly the sort of people who should get wanded before being allowed into a room with a guy. "You can't do that," said Drew. "Okay," I said, "but if one of these guys plugs the president, you're going to feel pretty stupid." Republicans made huge gains in the 2010 midterms, seizing the majority in the House and picking up 6 seats in the Senate. Worse, these gains were powered and the new House majority controlled by the ascendant Tea Party. These folks weren't just extremely conservative. They were openly uninterested in actual governing. They saw themselves not as legislators, but as revolutionaries. More than a few of them were just plain nuts. All year they'd been raising hell at town hall meetings, complaining about everything from the Affordable Care Act, more about this in a bit, to the president's secret Muslim heritage, more about this, I'm guessing, in Donald Trump's presidential memoir. Now they had come to Washington, and what's more, they were clearly running the show. At the 2011 State of the Union, I walked in with Rand Paul, the libertarian new senator from Kentucky, who had chosen me to be his mentor. Let me explain. After the 2010 election, I called all the winners on election night to congratulate them and welcome them to the Senate, even the Republicans. I thought that was what you do. It isn't. I guess I was the only Democrat who called Rand, and we had a nice conversation. So Rand picked me to be his Democratic mentor. He picked Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson for his Republican. I hadn't even been aware that there was a mentor program because I had been seated so late. Long and short of it, I was a terrible mentor. I advised Rand to be a workhorse and not a show horse, not realizing that he was planning to run for president at the first opportunity. Every once in a while, I'd ask Kay, "Is he listening to any of your advice?" "No," she'd say, slightly puzzled. So we walk into the House chamber, and I gave Rand some mentorly advice. "Rand, if the president says something you don't like, your job is to stand up and yell, 'You lie.'" Rand laughed and then added, "Actually, you know, that would be pretty good for fundraising." The chamber was crowded, and I had to scramble to find a seat, winding up next to Marco Rubio, another new Republican senator. I tried my joke again. "Marco, some advice. If the president says something you disagree with, get up and yell, 'You lie.'" Chuckling, Marco responded, "That'd be great for fundraising." I turned to my other side and poked Saxby Chambliss, a veteran Republican. "Saxby," I said, I just told Marco that if the president says something he doesn't like, he should get up and yell, "You lie." Saxby laughed and said, "Not a bad fundraising tactic." The message had clearly gotten through to Republicans, even the non-crazy ones. Not only were they not being punished for the strategy they'd embarked upon at the beginning of President Obama's term, but they were being rewarded for it by a conservative base hell-bent on destroying the guy. And so, instead of trying to tamp down the most extreme elements of their party, Republicans indulged them time and time again, sometimes even egging them on by promising victories that they knew were impossible, just to keep them on board and engaged. This dynamic manifested itself in years of ugly brinksmanship. For example, raising the debt ceiling had always been relatively routine, but with the Tea Party pulling House Speaker John Boehner's strings, it became an opportunity to take the fiscal future of the country hostage. Sign Paul Ryan's radical austerity budget into law, they threatened, or we'll force America to default on its debt for the first time ever. That's what these guys were about. As my friend Norm Ornstein, the guy who played Norm Ornstein for Indecision 92, and his less funny colleague Tom Mann would later write in their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, this new Republican Party was, quote, an insurgent outlier, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition. Even after they failed to defeat President Obama in 2012, Republicans had gone too far down this path to turn back. They had trained their base to respect nothing and to expect everything. While the GOP's official post-election autopsy urged moderation on issues like immigration, the activists who ran the show concluded that Mitt Romney had lost because he wasn't extreme enough. By the end of President Obama's second term, Republicans had failed to keep any of the promises they had made to keep the Tea Partiers on board and engaged. They hadn't repealed health care reform or defunded Planned Parenthood or proved that the president was born in Kenya. All they had done was break the damn government. With Republicans putting up a unified front of opposition, we made no real progress on big issues like immigration or tax reform. Even after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, we couldn't get an extremely mild gun safety bill through the Senate. And of course, they shut down the government for 16 days in 2013, costing the U.S. economy $24 billion. And the thing of it was, ordinary Americans who weren't themselves rabid partisans saw all this happening and blamed both sides. I was always amazed when I would go around Minnesota and meet people who didn't follow national politics that closely, but who knew that Republicans had been extremely uncooperative during the Obama administration. "I know," I'd say, "it's awful." "Yeah," these people would often respond, "but that's Washington for you." I never fully understood this "a pox on both houses" mentality until I read an article by Jonathan Rauch in The Atlantic last summer. He was talking about a study by a pair of political scientists in which they found that between 25 and 40% of Americans have a severely distorted view of how government and politics are supposed to work. Rauch calls these people politophobes. They see the contentious give and take of politics as unnecessary and distasteful. Specifically, they believe that obvious, common sense solutions to the country's problems are out there for the plucking. The reason these obvious solutions are not enacted is that politicians are corrupt or self-interested or addicted to unnecessary partisan feuding. These folks didn't reach that conclusion without some help. Many political reporters can't seem to write a sentence about a problem without casting at least some blame onto both sides. Congressional Republicans knew that and made hay with it. McConnell and his friends consistently blamed Obama for the partisanship of the Obama years, managing to suppress their giggles all the while. And too many journalists bought it. Take, for example, this blood-curdling artifact of Operation Curdle, a piece in Time magazine by Mark Halperin from December 2009 identifying the root cause of Obama-era partisan rancor. Once the new president cast his lot with his party in passing an economic stimulus measure rather than seeking bipartisan agreement, rival Republicans started digging in. Fortunately, the press cleaned up its act before 2016. Speaking of which, as the 2016 presidential campaign unfolded, and it became clear that Donald Trump might actually become the Republican nominee, pundits searched their pundit brains for answers to where the Trump phenomenon had come from, pinning the blame on everyone from Sarah Palin to Richard Nixon to Kim Kardashian. But the answer was right there in front of us the whole time. Yes, Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party had roots in the fact-free right-wing media bubble and in Newt Gingrich's pioneering of the politics of personal destruction in the 1990s. But his campaign grew directly out of the strategy Mitch McConnell implemented beginning at that retreat in West Virginia after Barack Obama won the White House in 2008, a strategy of total war against a Democratic president, a strategy in which no attack, no matter how false or outrageous, was out of bounds. When Republicans chose door number three, when they chose to become insurgent outliers, they unwittingly opened the door for Donald Trump. For the fat cat donors, special interest lobbyists, and elected officials who usually run the Republican show, wrote David Corn of Mother Jones, Trump is an invasive species. But he has grown large and strong in the manure they have spread across the political landscape. And after 8 years of refusing to help the president govern, in fact, 8 years of actively trying to make the country ungovernable, Republicans hadn't just created a monster within their own ranks. All that inaction and gridlock helped to create a nation of politophobes, people who correctly felt they were being left behind in the economy and correctly felt that the political system was broken and rigged against people like them, and extremely incorrectly felt that everyone who had anything to do with politics was more or less equally to blame. Rausch writes that these voters are inclined towards leaders who will step forward, cast aside cowardly politicians and venal special interests, and implement long overdue solutions. These leaders can be politicians, technocrats, or autocrats, whatever works, Rausch adds. Whether the process is democratic is not particularly important. Chapter 33, Healthcare. Now what? Donald Trump's healthcare plan, as expressed during his campaign, was as follows. Repeal Obamacare and replace it with something terrific. Okay, that's not the entire plan. Trump later elaborated on something terrific, explaining that his plan would be so much better, so much better, so much better. When he was elected, it became clear that repeal was now a real possibility. The replace part, however, was as much a mystery as it had always been. Over the previous 6 years, Republicans had voted more than 60 times to repeal the law. They had offered zero plans to replace it. That's not to say they didn't have ideas related to health care. For example, Republicans have always been big on tort reform, which means making it harder to sue for malpractice. Then there's the one actual idea Trump offered during the campaign, which is to allow health insurance companies to sell insurance plans across state lines. Here's the thing about that, by the way. There is no federal law that prevents it. It's up to the states to decide which health insurance companies can sell within their borders. In fact, since the ACA passed, six states have allowed insurance companies from outside their borders to offer policies to their citizens. And guess what? No health insurance company has done it. Why? Because in order to offer coverage in a given state, you need more than a license to do it. You need to learn the state, assess the healthcare needs of its population, set up a network of providers willing to accept your insurance, and advertise to customers. So that barely counts as an idea, and more importantly, has nothing to do with the central challenge of healthcare reform, which is making sure that nobody in America goes bankrupt because they get sick or hurt, or worse, goes without care they need because they can't afford it. By the time you listen to this, Republicans may well have succeeded in repealing some or all of the Affordable Care Act. But I'm willing to bet that they won't have succeeded in replacing it, because the truth is they've never been interested in addressing that central challenge. And they've been proving just how uninterested they are since the very beginning of this debate. Let's go back to 2008, when Barack Obama first ran for president and I first ran for the Senate. Getting to universal health care was at the center of our respective campaigns, and for good reason. Every developed country in the world had some form of universal health care except the United States, providing care for all their people and doing it at about half the cost and with better outcomes. During one of our debates, Norm Coleman had insisted that the United States already had the best healthcare system in the world, pointing to the Mayo Clinic in our home state. True, Mayo provides healthcare that is second to none on the planet, which is why Mayo is such a point of pride in Minnesota. The problem was that great healthcare delivered by a number of world-class hospitals and clinics doesn't make a health system. As T.R. Reid pointed out in his 2009 bestseller, The Healing of America, the United States didn't have a health system. We had a number of health systems. If you're in Medicare or Medicaid, you're in the Canadian system, single payer. If you're in the military or the VA, you're in the British system, socialized medicine. If you got your insurance through your employer, as most Americans did, you were in the German system. But if you didn't have any health insurance, you were in the Cambodian system, where one illness or injury could literally ruin or even end your life. More than half of all personal bankruptcies in America were caused, in part or entirely, by a health care crisis. And that statistic doesn't even count all the people, like Margie Hogan's young lupus patient, who were going without care that they needed because they didn't have insurance to pay for it. One reason so many people were trapped in the Cambodian system was that, before Obamacare, insurance companies could turn you down or charge you outrageous and possible premiums for coverage if you had a pre-existing condition like cancer, heart disease, or diabetes. I know it's hard to believe, but way back in 2009, that's the way it was. Nowadays, of course, pretty much everyone agrees that this is cruel and wrong. Even Donald Trump agrees. If you want everyone to have the security of health insurance, you can't let insurance companies deny coverage to people who have pre-existing conditions. But here's the catch. If no one can be turned down or charged more for having a pre-existing condition, well, then there's no incentive to actually get health insurance until the moment you need to use it. You might as well wait until you develop lupus or get a light bulb stuck up your butt before buying a policy. This is known as the free rider problem. If only sick or light bulbed people have insurance, then insurance becomes impossibly expensive to provide, and thus impossibly expensive to afford. So, if you want sick people to be able to get insurance without the insurance market collapsing, then healthy people have to have insurance too. Of course, some people in the Cambodian system didn't have insurance, not because they couldn't get an insurance company to cover them, but rather because they didn't have a job that provided insurance and didn't have the money to buy a policy on their own. So if you're going to require that everybody get insurance, you have to subsidize it for people who can't afford it otherwise. Hey, wait a minute. A lifeline out of the Cambodian system for people who didn't have insurance, an individual mandate to avoid the free rider problem, subsidies to make sure that people can afford the insurance they're required to have. This sounds an awful lot like Obamacare. And, of course, that's exactly the three-legged stool that formed the foundation of the Affordable Care Act. Here's what's important to understand about this model. The stool only works with all three legs. Without the subsidies, you can't have the mandate. Without the mandate, you can't have the ban on discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions. And without those protections for the most vulnerable Americans, you're right back where you started. If this sounds like a complicated way to solve the problem, well, it is. A simpler solution would have been just to go to a national single-payer plan like Canada's, Medicare for everyone. And many progressives, like Bernie Sanders, thought that that's what we should do back in 2009. Unfortunately, we needed 60 votes to pass anything, and we were, about 50 votes short. What would a conservative solution to the Cambodian system problem look like? Well, actually a lot like Obamacare. The three-legged stool model, in fact, originated with the very conservative Heritage Foundation and had been enacted in Massachusetts under a Republican governor with the improbable name of Mitt, where, by the way, it worked extremely well. Romney Care now covers 97% of Bay Staters, and both Republicans and Democrats there intend to keep it intact. No matter what Trump and my Republican colleagues do to Obamacare between the time I finish this book and the time you listen to it. So, if Republicans had any interest in getting people out of the Cambodian system, they could have supported the conservative framework in the Affordable Care Act. Or they could have offered some other alternative plan. But they refused to do either. Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, was determined to get a bipartisan bill. And in April 2009, he'd put together a gang of six, three Democrats, three Republicans, to start negotiating. Every Tuesday, when we meet for our caucus lunch, he'd report that they were getting closer to an agreement. This went on for months. Finally, at a lunch in late September 2009, Max acknowledged that the gang of six was at a complete impasse, and that he had finally concluded that Republicans never had any intention of reaching an agreement, no matter what was in it. At this, former Republican Arlen Specter interjected, "Well, I could have told you that." "Well, then why didn't you?" I thought to myself. By then, however, a tiny window had opened to allow us to get it done on our own without any help from the Republicans. Remember, when President Obama was sworn in, he had 58 Democratic votes. In April, Arlen Specter made it 59. But by the time I got there in July to make it 60, Ted Kennedy was bedridden in Hyannisport in the final stages of his battle with brain cancer, so we still really had only 59. Senator Kennedy passed away in late August. On September 24th, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick appointed Paul Kirk to fill his seat until a new senator could be picked in a special election the next January. Finally, for the first time, Democrats actually had the 60 votes we would need to move forward on health care. The bad news is that we would need every single one of those 60 votes, which meant every single one of us had a veto. Good luck, Harry Reid. Fortunately, Harry was exactly the right guy for this impossible job. Harry grew up in the hardscrabble Nevada mining town of Searchlight. He put himself through law school as a Capitol police officer. As chairman of the Nevada Gaming Commission, he had taken on the mob. His wife, Landra, once famously found a bomb attached to their car. Simply put, Harry Reid is a hard ass. As a young man, he had been a boxer. I once heard President Obama repeat what Harry told him about his career in the ring. "I wasn't the most talented guy. I wasn't very fast. I wasn't big, obviously. But I could take a punch." Harry's job on health care was to take punches, for President Obama and for everyone who was counting on him to deliver on the promise of reform. And boy, did he take a lot of punches, but he got it done. And that's why Harry Reid will always be a hero to me. Still, the math was a math, and it forced us to make some tough compromises. A handful of moderate to conservative Democrats were opposed to the public option, which would have increased competition in the insurance market. Gone. Someone floated the idea of lowering the age of Medicare to 55. Not a bad idea. Makes both pools healthier. Medicare adds some people between 55 and 65 who are, on average, healthier than people over 65, while the private health insurance market loses its oldest members. Okay, let's do it. But then Joe Lieberman announced on Face the Nation that he was against it. Gone. In November, we hit another hurdle. Ben Nelson told us he decided he needed tighter restrictions on federal funding for abortions. Great. Barbara Boxer, the Senate's staunchest supporter of a woman's right to choose, bit the bullet and negotiated a compromise with Ben. Women would have to make a separate second payment to their insurer to get coverage for abortion. We didn't like it, but we didn't have a choice. Finally, on Christmas Eve, we passed the bill through the Senate. Phew. Then, suddenly, things got even harder. In January, the not-whip-smart Scott Brown, a Tea Party Republican, won the special election for Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts. Democrats freaked out. Many saw Brown's victory as a sign that the Republican strategy was paying off so handsomely that it could give them control of Congress in that November's midterms and set the president up for a defeat in his 2012 re-election campaign. On top of that, our math problem had just gotten a lot worse, because once Brown took office in early February, that would be the end of our 60-vote, filibuster-proof supermajority. Wait, you're thinking, I thought you already passed the bill. Well, we had, and so had the House, but there were some differences between the two bills. Ordinarily, this wouldn't be a big deal. We'd convene a conference committee, hash out the differences, and then both chambers would vote to pass the unified bill that came out of the conference. But Republicans were still hell-bent on stopping us from passing health care reform, and now that they once again had 41 votes in the Senate, they could stop us from voting on that unified bill. So a conference committee would be out of the question. There was only one solution. The House would have to pass the exact same bill we had just passed. Guess who didn't like that idea? House Democrats. Liberals wanted provisions from the House's more progressive bill, and Democrats from more conservative districts were now spooked by Brown's victory in Massachusetts. We were stuck, and we needed the most important Democrat in the country to decide on a plan. No, not Rachel Maddow. President Obama. Unfortunately, many of the Democrats who were freaking out about Scott Brown's victory worked for the president. And some, most notably Obama's chief of staff Rahm Emanuel, wanted to give up and abandon health care reform altogether. It all came to a head on February 4, 2010, the day Scott Brown was sworn in. That day, President Obama spoke to Senate Democrats at a one-day emergency retreat at the Newseum, urging us to finish the job on health care. Except he didn't explain how he thought we could do that. When the president finished, the press left the room with him. Paul Begala, Tim Kaine, then chair of the Democratic National Committee, and David Axelrod were set to speak for about 5 minutes each and then take questions. Okay, I thought. Here comes the plan. Begala spoke for 5 minutes. Nothing about health care. Kaine spoke for 5 minutes. Again, nothing. Okay, I thought. I guess they're having Axelrod do it. After all, he's the president's chief political advisor, his guru, his guy. He's going to tell us the plan. David started talking. First minute, nothing on health care. Saving for the end. Classic. Second minute, still nothing. Same with the third. Between minute 4 and minute 5, it occurred to me that one of two things was about to happen. Either Axelrod was going to run over his allotted time, or he wasn't going to tell us the friggin' plan. And indeed, when he finished his 5-minute remarks, there was not one word about how we were going to solve the intractable political crisis facing the most important legislation in a generation. Questions. My hand shot up. Senator Franken. I exploded. I've been doing a slow burn for the last 5 minutes. I cannot believe we're not talking about health care. This is the president's signature legislation. We've been working on this for a year now. The House obviously has to pass exactly what we passed, word for word. What is the plan to make that happen? That's exactly what I said, except I dropped the F-bomb maybe 50 times. Axelrod responded that I wasn't being fair to the president, and that if I could tell him how to get the 218 votes in the House, he'd be happy to pass along my advice. That's the president's job, I yelled, inserting a single F-bomb before job. After some more back and forth, Bill Nelson and Carl Levin raised their hands. Each pointed out to Axelrod that he hadn't actually answered my question, although they managed not to swear at him, which was probably easy for Bill, a very devout Christian. And later that evening, President Obama announced at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser that he wanted the House to move forward with the Senate bill. Finally, after a few hair-raising weeks of negotiations and arm-twisting, the House passed the Senate bill as it was by a 219-212 margin, and the president signed the bill into law. For Axelrod's part, he didn't take my outburst personally. I think it probably helped that after the bill passed, I wrote him a nice note. It read, "You're welcome." The story of how the Affordable Care Act passed, then, goes something like this. Democrats looked at all the people who were one car accident or cancer diagnosis away from disaster, and all the people who were getting sick or even dying because they were trapped in the Cambodian system. And they saw it as a moral crisis. And they were willing to do whatever it took to address that moral crisis, navigating a narrow path through a political maze, voting for elements of the bill that they felt were imperfect or even counterproductive, opening themselves up to demagoguery or maybe even losing their jobs, swearing at David Axelrod. And Republicans? Well, I'm sure many of them felt bad for people like Margie's lupus patient, but I just think they cared more about winning the political fight, catering to the free market ideologues and conspiracy theorists in their base, and continuing to put up that unified front against President Obama. I don't think they were willing to do the work or make the sacrifices necessary to solve the problem. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that's changed since 2010. Because they've spent the last 7 years trying to stop the Affordable Care Act from working the way it was intended. For example, a group of Republican state attorneys general filed a lawsuit claiming that the individual mandate, the second leg of the stool, was unconstitutional because the federal government didn't have the power to force people to buy something. For 2 years, as the case worked its way through the court system, we were treated to constant rhetoric about Obama's unconstitutional overreach, and nobody was sure if the law would be allowed to stand. This, of course, was despite the fact that the Republicans' argument was ridiculous. You see, and this is important, the Founding Fathers wrote a constitution that gave almost all power to state governments and very, very little to the federal government. That constitution was called the Articles of Confederation, and it was a disaster. Then the founders wrote the United States Constitution, the one we have been living under since 1789. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of that constitution grants Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. Gee, you think the pharmaceuticals and medical devices used in healthcare involve any interstate commerce? That's why, as expected, when the court ruled in June 2012, its four liberal justices correctly voted to uphold the individual mandate under the Commerce Clause. But after a series of earth-shatteringly, mind-blowingly partisan 5-4 rulings, everyone had worried that the five conservative justices would swallow the Republicans' insane argument. And believe it or not, they did. But Chief Justice John Roberts, custodian of the court's reputation, knew that killing health care reform with a third, highly partisan, legally dubious, and immensely impactful 5-4 decision on the heels of Bush v. Gore and Citizens United might undermine any remaining confidence in the court's integrity once and for all. So Roberts voted with the liberals, agreeing that the mandate was constitutional. But he picked a different rationale, concluding that the mandate was allowable because the penalty imposed on people who didn't buy insurance was really a tax, which Congress is empowered by the Constitution to implement. Roberts' reasoning was so weird that Supreme Court reporters from both CNN and Fox News initially reported the ruling wrong. Also, critically, Roberts' decision included a drive-by shooting. It eliminated the requirement that states use federal dollars to expand their Medicaid programs, which would have helped cover millions more low-income Americans. An expert marksman, Roberts had aimed directly at the ACA's foot, weakening the law before it could even go into effect. Republicans hadn't succeeded in getting the court to block Obamacare, but they could take solace in the fact that Chief Justice Roberts had made it less good. The fact that the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect isn't entirely Republicans' fault. For example, there was a day in October 2013 when the new health insurance exchanges went live, and healthcare.gov, the website where people could shop for different policies, immediately crapped the bed. This was a really bad unforced error by the Obama administration, and people were right to be mad about it. I was furious. Another thing that really cheesed me off was the phone number. The administration had set up an 800 number for people to call to get help finding the right insurance plan for them. Great idea. What was the number? 1-800-GET-CARE? 1-800-ACA-HELP? 1-800-NOT-SICK? No, it was 1-800-318-2596. What does that spell? Nothing. If you added an extra digit to the end, you could get to 1-800-318-A-LINKS. But come on! You know how earlier I said the reason Democrats are bad at messaging isn't that we're idiots? Well, sometimes it is. And yes, some people have gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to the new law. Just a few weeks before the 2016 presidential election, voters learned that the average premium on the health insurance exchanges, established by the Affordable Care Act, was about to go up nearly 20%. These premium hikes presented a real hardship for many Americans, especially those in rural communities where the insurance markets feature less competition and offer consumers fewer choices in health insurers. Anyone who has to pay unreasonably high premiums or co-pays and whose income is just a little too much to qualify for a subsidy that could help has every right to be angry. But ask yourself who you should be angry at. That premium hike happened in no small part because fewer healthy people than expected signed up for health insurance through the exchanges, meaning the overall pool of people in the exchanges was sicker than expected, meaning that insurance companies participating in the exchanges were losing money, which led those insurance companies to bail on the exchanges. Why did fewer healthy people than expected sign up? Well, it probably didn't help that the Koch brothers ran ads featuring a demented Uncle Sam performing a gynecological exam on a millennial to scare young people away from the exchanges. Also, Republican state health commissioners did, quote, everything in their power to be an obstructionist. I said, quote, because those words were actually spoken by Republican Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens from Georgia. That's not the only way Republicans sabotaged the exchanges. They also deliberately changed the law to more or less guarantee that this would happen. You see, when we set up Obamacare, We'd anticipated exactly this problem, that the people signing up for insurance might be sicker than expected. So we built into the law several programs to mitigate the risk insurers faced when they entered this new market, helping make up for initial losses and keep them in the insurance market. One important program was called Risk Corridors, another example of Democratic messaging genius. But Republicans, led by the wilier-than-you-might-have-expected Marco Rubio, snuck a rider into a spending bill that killed off risk corridors, which meant insurance companies wound up only getting compensated for about 12% of what they were owed. Thus, a bunch of insurers waltzed. Premium shot up, and Rubio and his friends rubbed their hands together while cackling gleefully. Of course, we could easily be working on fixing the problem that caused these premium increases in the first place, perhaps by giving people more incentive to sign up for the exchanges, perhaps by changing the formulas for how insurance is subsidized for low and middle income people, perhaps by bringing back the idea of a public option to increase competition. As recently as November 7, 2016, is very excited about implementing these ideas as part of the new Democratic Senate majority under President Clinton. In fact, from the moment the law passed, Democrats have been open, even eager, to talk about how to improve it and address problems that have arisen as the law has taken effect. Because figuring out how to improve laws and address problems is kind of Congress's job. But Republicans have shown no interest in fixing Obamacare. And while it may be easy to dismiss their intransigence as politics as usual, that isn't how things usually go. For example, many Republicans vehemently opposed the creation of Social Security and then of Medicare, but that didn't stop them from supporting and in some cases even suggesting ways to improve those laws as it became clear where they needed improvement. One of President Bush's signature domestic programs was an expansion of Medicare. That's how things are supposed to work. If you are privileged enough to have a job as a lawmaker, part of your job is to make laws, and if you don't like the way the law is working, your job is to help make it work better. But that's not what Republicans thought their job was. Just like with the stimulus, they first tried to stop health care reform from happening at all, which was their right. But then they tried to make it as ineffective as possible so they could complain that it wasn't working. Since then, they voted more than five dozen times to repeal it, even shutting down the government over health care reform in an effort led by Ted Cruz, about whom I'll have a word or two later in the book. Neither of them good. And, of course, they lied about it the whole way. Before it passed, they confidently predicted horrors that never wound up happening. Obamacare is going to force more Americans into working part-time so their employer doesn't have to provide them health care. Employers are going to stop covering their employees and dump them into the exchanges. Nope, none of that happened. After it passed, they started inventing horrors to complain about. Obamacare has killed millions of jobs, they said millions of times. In fact, since the ACA passed, our economy has created more than 16 million new jobs. And even though some people have had a bad experience with the new law, the fact is that for most Americans, the law is unquestionably a net winner. Most Americans, around two-thirds of workers, continue to get their insurance through their employer. In the decade before Obamacare became law, their premiums rose at an average of 7.1% per year. In 2016, their premiums rose by an average of 2.9%. As for the 4% of Americans who get their insurance through the exchanges, roughly 80% of them receive subsidies. Nearly 3 out of 4 have the option of purchasing coverage for less than $75 a month. As for our healthcare system, it's on steadier footing than it's ever been. Before the ACA, the growing cost of healthcare had become unsustainable, more than doubling over the previous 10 years, and even threatening the long-term future of Medicare. That's why the law included measures designed to try to restrain that growth, what's known as bending the cost curve. This isn't the most exciting part of healthcare reform, except to me, which is why we had to sex it up with an exciting catchphrase like bending the cost curve. But it's important, so bear with me for a minute. Early on in the debate, I became fascinated with an article in The New Yorker by Atul Gawande, a surgeon, public health researcher, and professor at Harvard School of Public Health, who had been a frequent guest on my radio show. His piece compared Medicare spending in McAllen, Texas, with Medicare spending at the Mayo Clinic in my home state. McAllen was spending 3 times more per person than Mayo was, even as Mayo was delivering far better outcomes. Clearly, Mayo was delivering healthcare more efficiently and effectively than McAllen. If we could figure out how and spread those methods to other places, we could improve outcomes even while, here it comes, bending the cost curve. One of the methods Mayo used was something called coordinated care. By the time people get into Medicare, they usually have more than one thing wrong with them. As a 70-something woman told me at the Minnesota State Fair that summer, at my age, everything is pre-existing. So the Mayo Clinic has every specialty, cardiology, orthopedics, oncology, in one location. Smart. Another thing. At Mayo, all the doctors are on salary. What they get paid doesn't depend on how many tests they order or how many procedures they perform. Doctors at Mayo see their patients as patients. In McAllen, on the other hand, doctors were paid by the procedure, which meant they were incentivized to see patients as profit centers. For example, as Gawande reported, doctors in McAllen owned the imaging centers. So they made money on every CAT scan and MRI they ordered. And no surprise, they ordered a lot of CAT scans and MRIs. Meanwhile, a doctor in a system like that gets nothing if a patient avoids getting diabetes. But there's a big payday for a surgeon if he gets to remove a diabetic's foot. No wonder so much money was getting spent on healthcare that didn't actually make people healthier. Because of screwy incentives, doctors in McAllen, like in much of America, weren't delivering health care. They were delivering sick care. If we could get more places to do health care like Mayo and not like McAllen, we could make a big difference. This area of focus is known as delivery reform. And there's another reason I was so focused on it. As it turns out, Minnesota is really good at delivering quality and cost-effective care, consistently leading national rankings. If every state did health care as well as Minnesota does, we'd spend less and have better outcomes. I've always seen it as part of my job to bring the best of my state to Washington, and I was able to bring 2 Minnesota innovations to the health care debate that made it into law. One is called the National Diabetes Prevention Program, and it offers nutritional instruction and physical training to pre-diabetics, reducing the odds that they'll develop diabetes, which is far more expensive to treat than it is to prevent. The other is called the Medical Loss Ratio, or MLR, which mandates insurance companies spend at least 80 cents of every dollar you pay in health insurance premiums on actual health care, as opposed to administrative costs, marketing, CEO salaries, or profits. And that, if an insurance company fails to meet that standard, it has to rebate the difference to policyholders. Thanks to these reforms and many others, the law has been hugely successful in bending the cost curve. Since it passed, the cost of health care has indeed continued to rise, but has been rising at about half the rate it had during the previous decade. And in 4 of the last 5 years, the growth in healthcare spending has been slower than at any other time in the last half century. As for McAllen, Texas, the city that had the highest Medicare spending per capita in the country, McCallum has brought down the cost of its health care for Medicare recipients by nearly $3,000 per capita because of incentives in the ACA to reward coordinated care and other health care delivery reforms. Forget about bending the curve. This was reversing it altogether. Repealing Obamacare means wiping out all that progress, not just the delivery reform, but the 20 million people who didn't have insurance and got it thanks to the ACA, and the 153 million people with pre-existing conditions who were saved from worrying that they'd be discriminated against, and all the young adults who gained the ability to stay on their parents' insurance, and every American who got a flu shot or a long overdue checkup and didn't get handed a bill at the end. All these people have a lot riding on whether Republicans really mean it when they say they're going to replace Obamacare with something that protects them. After Trump won the presidency, repeal and replace was itself replaced with repeal and delay. The idea was that the Affordable Care Act would be repealed immediately, but the repeal wouldn't go into effect until after the 2018 midterm elections, thus buying Republicans some time to think of an idea for how to replace it. The only way this isn't the dumbest idea in the world is if the thing you care most about is the politics, being able to boast to your base that you've succeeded in repealing Obamacare, while making sure that you can get reelected in the midterms before the rest of the country figures out how devastating repeal would be. And even then, they still have to come up with a plan. But if it doesn't cover people with pre-existing conditions, guarantee that people won't go bankrupt if they get sick, and continue to bend the cost curve, then it isn't replacement at all. In fact, President Trump has gone on record promising that Republican replacement will cover every American, give them the same or better benefits, and cost less. I'm all ears. The truth is, I don't really believe that the Republicans are ever going to come up with a real replacement for the Affordable Care Act, because it seems to me that they don't actually care about making sure that every American has access to quality, affordable health care. What do they care about? They want insurance companies to be able to sell you junk policies. They want drug manufacturers to be able to gouge people who rely on medications to stay healthy. They want to make it harder for people who've suffered from medical malpractice to get their day in court. They want rich people to not have to pay for health care for poor people. And most of all, they want to keep using this issue to rally their base, reward their donors, and punish Democrats. I don't know what's going to happen going forward. Heck, I don't even know what's going to happen between the time I finish this book and the time you listen to it. But what I do know is this. Anyone who trusts this Republican Party with the future of our nation's health care system simply hasn't been paying attention. Chapter 34. I Meet George W. Bush. Hey, how about a palate cleanser? Here's an interesting story, or at least a story at any rate. In the spring of 2015, I was invited to a Major League Baseball dinner at the Hay Adams Hotel right across the street from the White House. Dinners in D.C. are an enormous time suck, so I try to avoid them if I possibly can. But a number of the team owners, including Jim Polad of the Minnesota Twins, were going to be there, so I accepted the invitation to sit at his table. Mitch McConnell and Speaker Boehner came as well because the owner of the Cincinnati Reds was there, and Dianne Feinstein was seated with the owner of the San Francisco Giants. It was a nice evening, about 50 people. After cocktails and dinner, the new commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, welcomed everybody. Mitch and John Boehner gave nice remarks about being lifelong Reds fans. Boehner's from Cincinnati, and Mitch's hometown, Louisville, Kentucky, is right down the Ohio River from, well, Riverfront Stadium, where the Big Red Machine dominated the National League during most of the 1970s. And then Dianne got up to the podium to talk about the importance of the Giants to San Francisco. As I listened to Dianne, I noticed a slight change in the sound of the room. I turned around and saw former President George W. Bush and his wife Laura standing at the back, smiling. Diane acknowledged the president and Laura and wrapped up. Then the new commissioner invited the former Texas Rangers owner and commander-in-chief to make a few remarks. As Bush walked up to the podium, we all gave him a standing ovation. I thought he was a terrible president, but he had been the president, and I wanted to show respect for his office. He seemed really loose and happy and started with a joke. "Usually I do this for money." Good laugh. "I hope Bill and Hillary don't ruin it for me." Big laugh. He was referring, of course, to the recent headlines about the crap loads of money the Clintons had been raking in for public speaking gigs. Funny and topical. Not bad. He spoke for 5 minutes, another standing ovation. I said my goodnights to the folks at my table and made my exit, heading toward the door farthest from the podium in order to avoid running into the former president, whom I had savaged to great comedic and commercial success. But as I turned around and headed in that